Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2019. Can you believe that, guys? We're doing another lager show, and we're doing it for a reason. My good buddy Jeff Lyons from Keg and Lantern Brewery. I'm lucky I still get these awesome emails each week from different New York City breweries, and it lists all the beers you can buy when you're a beer bar. And Jeff's jumped out at me. It was Helles. There's a Martzen, there's a Dortmunder, and I thought, I think it's time to do another lager show. So, Jeff, thanks for thinking of those beers, and thanks for coming on, man.
Oh, absolutely. Always happy to be here and be on your show and hang with you, and yeah, love brewing lagers, so that's no sweat.
We got a whole lager crew here, so we got everybody introduce themselves.
Pete Lindjohn, KCBC.
And Pete, you just made a really cool collaboration with Jack's Abbey, right?
Yeah, it's a double collab action. We did a Volmond beer February 19th under a full moon. So a bunch of their guys came down and brewed at our brewery. I went up and brewed at theirs. We made two different beers. They're more of a Märzen. The other we're calling a Munich Helles. Ours is all Massachusetts ingredients at the New York brewery. And they did all New York ingredients at their brewery up there.
Well, that's great. So looking forward to tasting that. We'll be talking about a lot of different lager styles. And another brewer.
Sven from Sven L. Brewing Company. We have a unfiltered lager called Born Too Loose, and we have a Martzen. It's actually a Keller Martzen, and we brewed that in a collaboration with Covenhoven for their fifth anniversary, which will be released here on Friday.
Great. And your brewery is up in the Hudson Valley?
We are located in Middleton, and we're planning a tasting room opening this summer up there, and we just opened a tasting room on Court Street in Kale Gardens.
In Brooklyn, yeah.
In Brooklyn.
Great. And one of my favorite home brewers, now you're a pro brewer.
Yeah, Alex Biederman with Keg and Lantern Brewery. And it's actually, I think today might mark my first full year working full-time with Jeff over at the brewery in Greenpoint.
That's great.
I'm horrible because I didn't realize that.
He gave me nothing.
Well, this is what he gave you. You're on the air. But let's talk about lager. So, Jeff, it was so great to open your sales email and say, wow, beers like Dortmunder and Helles and Martzen. Let's go back a little bit a few years. When did you first start making lagers? It's funny. We did three. This is our third lager show of this year. We did the Rothaus Pills show a couple weeks ago, and we did a show with Be United with some of their specialty Czech lagers recently.
Yeah, I heard those. Those were both great shows. I'm one of those anomalies where I didn't like macro lager, and so I just kind of refused to drink it underage. I found other ways to sort of alter my reality until I, got a little bit older, past drinking age before I really got into beer. But I think I continued because of that. I never really got into lagers until I was working at Greenpoint Beer and Ale with Chris Prout and Eric Olson. And, you know, Chris was really, really excited about making these lagers. And we'd give him a full lagering. You know, we'd be like 5, 6, 7 weeks. And we'd finally get it on tap. And he'd just be so giddy all day long, knowing that we were going to be able to sit down at the end of the shift and drink some lager. And to me, I'm coming from that macro, like, whatever. Wasn't that excited until we sat down with him and his enthusiasm was just contagious. And then you start drinking the beer with him and it's not just that feeling. Now it's like, oh man, this is a whole other thing. This is so much better than different, in my opinion, better than what I'd had, you know, tasting growing up, what the options were. And all of a sudden it was just sort of like the whole world was new and just kind of blew the doors off of what your conception of what lager was. And sort of all started there.
Yeah, they're like nuanced, refined, subtle. It's not an IPA. There's not a lot going on, but there is when you look at it, you know, closely. And I don't know. It's kind of maybe like punk musicians starting to play jazz or something.
Speaking my language now. Yeah.
So Pete, when you're up, you went to Massachusetts with New York Ingredients.
Yeah.
Made a beer at Jack's Abbey.
Yeah. And then same night, so we did it mostly at night because it's a Vollmond beer, which means full moon in German. And it's a kind of a classic style, which we had, I guess Jack had sort of determined it was a Märzen originally, close to. And we wanted to kind of spin it on our end, so we did a kind of flip the ingredient, the malt bill, and made ours a lighter one. We went more heavy on the pills, lighter on the Munich. And so we got two kind of different beers, two locally sourced but different state ingredients, and they both turned out really, really good. Super excited.
I love the different lager styles. I mean, I forget how much I like them, you know, from Märzens and Helles. And Alex, you know, we were talking about things you like to experiment with. One thing about lagers is the subtleties of the ingredients.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know what I've been trying to do at home, and I think we've done it quite a few times at Keg and Lantern as well, is just start bringing in alternative grains that maybe you don't think of. Adjuncts, I guess, as we're supposed to call them. And I think you can, everything else is so stripped back that you can really dial in what the character might be of a given grain or a different thing that comes to play. And I think it's also interesting, we're targeting it from the side of New York ingredients lately and kind of trying to figure out what does the New York barley really taste like? What does the kilning from the various maltsters taste like? And I think it's a relatively new playground. There aren't as many craft lagers out there, and now everyone's kind of starting to do them. And I think we're going to start seeing, you know, a lot of diversity. Whereas initially it was just, oh, let's make a Pilsner. It's sort of expanding from there.
Sven, you know, a year ago I had some of your beers, and I was definitely drinking the IPA. Have you been making lagers since the beginning as well?
Yes. I mean, being from Denmark, lagers are a priority, and quite frankly, not the very first beer that I brewed, but the second or the third, both as a home brewer but also professionally. It was always a priority. And the Born Too Loose has been on our program from the beginning.
That's great.
Yeah. We use New York State ingredients, primarily 1886 malt house, and that actually is a... gives us exactly what we're looking for malt-wise. And our hops are American Zass, and we use Chinook as well.
And Pete, at KCBC, you guys have always made some lagers too, lagers and pills.
Yeah, we're lager lovers.
What's the first one that you worked on?
I think the first one I put out was probably Strap Hanger, which is our 20% rice lager. It's an adjunct lager.
I just have to jump in and... Not only is that an amazing beer that I would love regardless, but a little over 2 years ago, my wife and I, we got married, and Pete and Zach and Tony were nice enough to let us come after we got married and have a bunch of our friends come in and drink some beer with us and celebrate that night at KCBC. And Strap Hanger was super brand spanking new that day or that week, whatever. You know, it's an amazing beer anyways, but that's always going to have such a special place in my heart. get excited every time it comes back up.
And your liver.
Well, how did you make that beer, Pete? I mean, it's like a throwback.
Yeah, it's,
rice lager.
It's, you know, Budweiser's a rice lager. I've heard 30% rice. I've also heard syrup, but this one's flaked rice and best Pilsner malt. We've done 3470 or German lager 3. Lager strains are all pretty similar, but this is a pretty basic one. Low sulfur, low diacetyl. And Hallertau hops, classic German hops, Magnum for bittering. It's a simple beer, but like Alex was saying, the adjunct in this case really shines through because it's 20% of a very simple malt bill. There's not a lot to hide behind. And we've been making it ever since. We're actually going to make a special batch soon. We've got a brewer, Trevor, who had this idea of making sort of a brute lager, like a brute IPA. But he wants to amylase our strap hanger and dry it out completely so it's more like a light lager. And we're going to do a strap hanger version of that. And we brought in American lager yeast for that particular brew and the one that we just did as well. But
Alex, can you picture how that would taste?
Not entirely, actually. I mean, it just sounds... I made a brute today, actually, on our system. And I know that stuff really strips everything out. Well, it just dries it to zero, usually. So yep. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and are you excited to make that beer?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're up for the challenge.
So what's the process like? Because you do a lot of collaborations, Pete and Jeff, and you know, you're trusting this member of your team to try something new. Do you do any test batches before you do a full batch?
We don't test batch anything, but we don't have the time. It takes longer to brew a pilot beer than it does to make, you know, full batch production batch. But and we're just trying to keep those tanks full.
Yeah, pretty similar idea with us, and we're making 3 barrels at a time. But even if we were making 50 or 100, quite honestly, at this point, everybody in this room is really comfortable with what you're doing and the process, and you have a pretty good grasp of what the ingredients are going to do. You can kind of picture when you write a recipe what you're going for and what you're going to turn out with, and I think we're all pretty comfortable just jumping right in and seeing what it turns out.
We do like to experiment a bit with collaborations, though. We kind of take that opportunity to throw a wild card in the mix.
Let's taste the KCBC beers too. You know, one of the questions I had was about here it is. I got to read this one. Reading from the list. Are lagers becoming popular again? that's a general question, and a lot of larger craft breweries have been making them for a while. You know, there's Firestone and you know, Lagunitas and Night Shift and the Founders make lagers, but you know, that's a good general question. Are they really becoming popular?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
At least I'd say amongst the brewers and maybe the more seasoned craft beer drinker, like people that are kind of new to craft beer, maybe aren't ready for something that subtle. They want a little more hops, a little more character and stuff. But when you've been drinking IPA for years and years and years, you kind of burn out on it a little bit and start looking for to spread, you know, widen your palate and maybe try some sour beers, maybe try classic styles, and then you work your way into lagers eventually.
What do you guys like for lagers? I mean, I'm going to say Notch Brewing up in Salem, Mass. I love that he focuses on these Czech style lagers, a lot of amber and other like darker colored lagers. Everyone say a lager that they like or a brewery that's making lager that they like a lot.
Well, I think we're really lucky to have Jack's Abbey doing what they're doing and pushing out the volume that they are to where at this point you can walk into what you'd normally call a dive bar and get the house lager so many places. It's a really nice treat to have them producing it at a rate that's almost like the macros as far as, you know, where we end up being, right?
Yeah, their brewery is massive, and they're really cranking out a huge volume of beer and really, really good beer. And they're doing a lot of hoppy lagers as well, so they're kind of, you know, keeping the kids happy, but they do a lot of classic styles as well.
And what size batch did you make when you were there?
I think it was a 100-barrel batch, yeah.
Same thing, you guys, you just put the recipes together and...
Yeah, and we did a 37-barrel batch at our brewery. We got kind of awkward-sized tanks, but That's a full batch for us. We got two new fermenters that we can put 45 barrels in, but everything else is 37.
Wow. What about you, Sven?
We are fortunate that we are very close to Suarez Family Brewery. So that's a treat. Go over there on the weekends and have their pilsners, lagers.
And you told me that 25 years ago, what was the first lager you had in America?
Saturday night, exploring New York and not knowing much about American beers other than the obvious. And I was presented for Rolling Rock. And...
You know, the reason I brought that up is I don't know, but I used to drink Rolling Rock about 25 years ago. We don't usually talk about those old school beers, but I haven't heard about Rolling Rock in probably 20 years. I don't know if it resonates with anybody.
I brought it up because I just thought about it. I was like, damn, that
Old Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
That was what I was sending for.
Last Man, Line God Tanks. That beer has residual DMS in it as part of the character of the beer, and it's kind of a good example if you're trying to train someone on off flavors. In some cases, it's not considered an off flavor. It's part of the character of the beer, but yeah. it's interesting that it has DMS.
Plus the Mercaptan from the green bottles, right?
Yeah, and it's skunked. So it's a two-hitter.
That's why we haven't heard about it in a long time.
It's got character back in the day when there was no character in most beers, so it's got something.
And I remember floating down rivers just outside of Cincinnati with an inner tube next to me full of Rolling Rock. So
yeah,
yeah, time and a place for it.
Yep.
That's cool. What about you, Alex?
I have the same answer as Sven. I think Suarez is doing such great, like, finessed lagers, and they're doing a broad variety of styles, so you'll get a Vienna. Next thing you know, there's a Schwartz beer around, and I think he's just kind of hitting it out of the park with those kind of beers lately, and they're super drinkable. I think some of the aspect of brewing all the time and thinking about beer all the time, it's nice with lager that it's a beer you can think about or you don't have to at all. And I feel like his are kind of like that. They're fantastic beers, but you can also just drink one and not really worry about it. So
I think we're so lucky in New York. We have Suarez, which we kind of occasionally see down here semi-regularly. And then we have things like Metric from Industrial Arts. And then you come in even closer, you know, down into the five boroughs. And you know, we have people like Threes making Vleet at a level that, you know, again, you can just see that everywhere. Phenomenal. And it's such an excellent, well-made beer. And then you've got some smaller guys that fly a little bit under the radar, which totally appeals to me, guys. Guys like Folksbeer.
Excellent.
Making some great beers.
So Gunhill, Crisp Pout, still banging them out.
Absolutely.
Other Half's made some really good lagers.
Other Half has?
Oh, yeah.
And what is Gunhill made? What lagers are they making?
Well, their mainstay is the Spirit of 76. Is that right?
Yeah, that's I think Spirit that's 76. His New York lager as well. It's got a percentage.
We got to get them on. I haven't had Gunhill on in a long time.
I reached out to Chris, and he's just too busy to get all the way from the Bronx on a double brew day down here in time, but yeah.
We're going up to make a Czech lager with Chris sometime soon. I forgot the date, but and then we'll bring him back down and we'll try to sneak him in.
For sure, man. And tell us, let's all talk about this beer because it got a lot of fanfare. I saw it on your email this week. I was excited to try it.
Yeah.
So this is the Jack's Abbey. This is the one that was made in...
This is ours, made here in New York.
Made in New York.
With Massachusetts Malton hops. 4.8%. It's Pilsner, Munich, and Vienna. I think we got the Munich from Valley Malt and the Vienna maybe, and the base malt were from Stone Path. And then we got some, I think they're called Four Star Farms Crystal Hops, which is kind of their, as they said, noblest hop. And it worked out quite well. It's got a nice kind of slight lemony citrus character. It's not over the top. We wouldn't want it to be over the top hoppy because it's kind of a malt forward lager beer. And I think it's great. We've been crushing it straight out of the bright tank as soon as we got it carved. Before we got it carved up.
You like it, Sven?
Oh, I love it. It's amazing. It's perfect. I enjoy the complexity.
Speechless.
But the complexity from all the different malts that you
Again, simple, yeah. But there is a lot going on. There's some layering, and they're working together, and they're like passing the baton from Pilsner to the Vienna in the middle, and then the Munich, and back around in a circle. It's like smoothed out, balanced. It's lagered for 6 weeks. We packaged it yesterday. Jack came down last week, tried it. He was really happy with it. I haven't had our version up there yet, but they say it's spot on. They're really digging it. They've been sending, you know, text and photos back and forth, and can't wait to try it. We're going to do some events together when we launch them.
That hop's really nice, too. Like you said, the lemon citrusy thing, but also, you know, it's sort of harkens enough back to the Noble S character. It's really nice.
I just love it. Wasn't too many years ago that I remember a Folks Beer opened, and he was like, he made a really good pills, and he said it almost put him out of business because it took up all his tanks. It takes a little more time. It's really nice to see in this room, you know, the attention to lagers and just how far the industry's come in New York City. On that note, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources the highest quality and most unique cheeses and other products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia, and imports them to the United States, many under the Mitika brand. If it's Mitika, it's got to be incredible. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it's our 10th anniversary, heritageradionetwork.org. You can become a member. A lot of good things happening this year. But right now, it's another lager show with some of my favorite brewers in New York. Pete Langle from KCBC, Sven from Svendale, Alex and Jeff from Keg and Lantern. So it's fun to have another lager show. This is our third lager show this year. Alex, you had a question for Pete?
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, I know I've heard that Jack gets pretty into these like regional lagers and discovering a lot, and I was curious whether there were commercial Full Moon beers out there.
Yeah, I don't think there are currently. I think maybe it was Jack or maybe Joe Connolly. He's the head brewer at the Springdale side of the house, but I think one of those guys found just like some obscure historical reference or something. Maybe a couple, and they. I don't remember the email exactly, but I think they sort of determined it was a Meritzen.
So was it like a biodynamic agriculture thing? You have to make it with the full moon?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's for the yeast, the gravitational pull of the moon.
Wow.
And, you know, there's a brewer in Italy who plays classical music to his fermentation tank, so maybe there's something there.
Scandinavians screaming as they pitch.
Screaming at the Kvike. We're a Kvike brewery now, too, but we haven't screamed at anything yet.
Keep going, Pete. This is good.
You're not doing it right, dude.
Yeah, classical screaming.
From what I hear.
Last time we had you.
Yeah, we were talking about that yeast last time. We've been using it for a while now. We're really excited about it.
What are some beers that you've made with it?
Lots of beers. We switched over our house IPA to Kvike, the Superhero Sidekicks. It was Dry English before. Pretty much every ale and beer we're putting out now that's hoppy or not a lager or not a Kolsch or anything is Kvike at this point.
So we haven't talked about this. I'm curious. Is this mostly a speed thing, or are you finding character that you really like?
It's for me. I was more interested in the production capacity. Like we could maybe get the beers out a little faster and still have a clean fermentation. The temperature range goes really high, and we're kind of restraining it at 85 Fahrenheit for a couple of days at least, and then let it go. It's almost done in 2 days, so we're still kind of figuring out this yeast. Like as far as we're trying to harvest this, and then get an early dry hop in, and it's got a really tight window. So if you don't get it, if you don't let it sit long enough, it's not going to flocculate out. If you wait too long, the fermentation's done. You drop your dry hop in, you're going to get diacetyl from the hop creep. So it's got a really tight window for that. Also been messing around with dialing in the oxygen. I'm trying to figure out how much this yeast needs. And definitely went too low on one turn, and it took like, it was like normal fermentation. It was 4 or 5 days to finish out, where normally 2 to 3 days, it's completely done. You'll extend the fermentation when you throw on the heavy dry hop, because your drop I think we've discussed hop creep in the show before, but there are enzymes in hops that will start breaking down dextrins and making fermentable sugars in your beer, in your finished beer, not your wort. And you get a secondary fermentation from that. And you get a secondary evolution of diacetyl, which is a problem. And if the yeast drops out, it's not going to clean up that diacetyl. So we've had to croizen a couple of beers with this to clean it up. So we're learning a lot. We're going to get there. I think we're looking pretty good right now. But trying to harvest this yeast and get an early dry hop in and doing a massive dry hop, these are all these parameters that we're dealing with right now. And oxygen is one of the big ones we found because I dialed it way back one time. Been listening to too many podcasts. Modern Times have been doing a lot of research on oxygen. And we do a lot of hops early on. I worry about oxidizing those hops. If you're putting excess oxygen, your yeast will consume it eventually, but it's in there. And you got hop oils in your wort when you're sending it into the tank, you're going to oxidize them. So you want to minimize the oxygen, but every yeast has a different oxygen requirement. And this one's thirsty for oxygen, I found. So we're doing a lot of work and we're figuring out a lot of stuff, but I think we're really happy with the yeast. But so far it hasn't really, shorten our tank residency time because we're getting some diacetyl and we have to fix that. So we'll get there eventually.
Let's go back to, this is a good yeast class. Alex, you were nodding to Jeff. You want to say anything about the yeast class?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know much. I haven't used this yeast myself, but we've talked a lot to us. The one of the people from Omega who markets a lot of the, these Lance. Strains, yeah, came and spoke to the homebrew club that I'm still a member of, the Bruminaries, and I was all excited because I'm kind of a mixed fermentation. I'm very interested in that kind of yeast, and so I was excited by the characters. And then the pitch was kind of that they're very fast, and that was simultaneously appealing and also disappointing to me because I thought these Norwegian yeasts were going to come with all this crazy farmhouse character, but in actuality, they're not phenolic. They don't produce a ton of esters. The appeal is that you only have to chill to a fairly high temperature, pitching temperature, and then they just rip and you're done with a beer. I mean, people in my club now are like trying to turn around, a 7-day beer, which you can do, but I mean, in a different way now. I mean, they're making beers that they want to serve in like 4 days.
Yeah, we're not trying to rush our beer. Let me just be clear. But our IPAs, I track all of our fermentations, and they were taking on average 17 days tank time. And I was like, if we could shave off 1 day, that'd make a difference. 2 days. But we wait. The beer is the boss, as we say. Picked that up from Brooklyn Brewery. And when the beer is done, and not before. So we're not trying to rush it, but if we can make a better beer and get it done a little bit faster, we'll sign on for that. And it's a really interesting yeast. And it does kind of produce an orangey ester, and then if you push it, it's supposed to... This is the Voss, Sigmund's Voskvik. If you push it, it's supposed to get this kind of earthy character. We don't really want that. So we're keeping it at 85 for now, and we might try to, push it up a bit once we figure out all the other parameters for the yeast. But for now, 85. After 1 day now, we'll let it free rise up to 90, but at that point, you've already gone through all the amino acid production and the fusels and all that produce the esters, so it should be safe. But it's so fast with this yeast, so all the timelines moved up on everything, except for still got to figure out when you get those hops in and how you deal with the hop creep and the diacetyl.
I love that we're going deep on yeast because it's probably the thing, part of beer we've talked the least about over the years. But that let's go back to it. The Kvek yeast from Scandinavia.
Yeah,
we talked about that last fall. How did people figure out that this was such a useful yeast that's been spreading?
Apparently they've been using it in Scandinavia forever. Like these are heritage yeast, I guess. I think they would dry it out and cut it into like coins and store it on a string and just pass it along like change to people. It's an incredibly hardy yeast. It's been selected to be hardy just by the way they stored it and passed it on.
Thank you.
And I think some brewers and maybe some yeast people heard, oh, God, there's this yeast that's clean at 85. If you produce a beer with most of our ale strains other than, like, maybe Saison strains at that temperature, you're going to have a terrible beer. When the yeast are fermenting that hot and that fast, they're going to produce a lot of alcohols other than ethanol. And these are called fusels, and they're terrible. They're really harsh. They're really hot and boozy. And that's the main issue. They're also going to produce a lot of esters, which are these fruity characters, which some of them are not fruity, and they're terrible. And you might even get into some phenolics, which are these kind of spicy aromatics if you push yeast really far. So normally they're not good, and that's why we restrain fermentations to about 68 for most strains, because you need to keep a clean fermentation, but it does take longer. And this strain, you can ferment at 85, 90, 100, and it's clean, and you can get the fermentation done a lot faster. It's perfect for homebrewers, because most, starting out at least, don't have temperature control, and that's a huge barrier to making good beer, especially in the summertime in an apartment in New York City or somewhere. It was always a challenge. And so a lot of brewers would just make saisons in the summertime, which are a little more temperature
forgiving.
Yeah. They will produce some character, but it's not bad character.
In theory.
But now they could use Kveik.
I think we've all had so many bad saisons at homebrew meetings just because that was the given.
Yeah. Summertime saison season. But
I've had some bad pine needle resin homebrews. But Jeff, tell us about this beer. So this is a Keg and Lantern. I want to taste through all the different lagers and say a few things about some of the styles too. I mean, you can look all this stuff up. I mean, you guys went through all the BJCP programs with me at Jimmy's Number 43. So it's easy to learn about styles, but to actually taste them and be making them, there's some challenges to it.
Certainly. I think because so early on, I found, first off, the Bruisers, which is how I initially met Pete, the Brooklyn Bruisers. As soon as I started brewing, I found that. And then I found the New York City Homebrewers Guild. And the very first meeting I went to with the Homebrewers Guild, I kind of got cornered by two very well-meaning individuals who basically wouldn't let me out of the corner until I swore to them that I would get in touch with Vlad the next day and sign up for the BJCP class in your basement, in your back room, and go through that. And I think within that first, 3 or 4 months of when I started homebrewing, to start going through all those classic styles, talking about them from people who actually know what they're talking about, and then tasting all these classic beers that fit in or just outside of those, was one of the most amazing things that I could have been pushed to do early on. And I think it just, it took my learning curve on a completely different path. So I'm very thankful for that. But that's sort of how I feel very fortunate to have gone through that. And then I started brewing at home, sort of working through those styles myself. Like, I tasted these things. I'm sort of interested in what I tasted with these classic beers. How do you make that at home? And it just sort of snowballed into really enjoying these beers and looking around and seeing what craft beer is, which is beautiful, but then seeing this gap that not everybody's making these things. And I think there's a way to take this super new, fresh approach that you're bringing in with all this fresh blood and being so young in this, but then approaching these really classic older styles with a different perspective and trying to be true to them, but sort of taking a little bit of almost that punk rock attitude to it and just going at it a different way.
Yeah. What's this beer?
So this is we call this Stolen Valor. This is a Bohemian Pilsner. So basically like a classic Czech pils, more or less. So it's all, floor malted Bohemian Pilsner malt from Weyermann, which is a German maltster, but I think the grain is actually from Slovenia. Or not. Is that right? But all the
he's hops, asking Alex. Do you know Alex?
No.
I'm looking for verification. I think. but then all the hops are from or Saaz hops from Czechoslovakia. So super super traditional in the recipe. But I think where we come in when I started brewing at Keg and Lantern, we were making lagers every so often. PJ was, but it wasn't a mainstay. And I think that was one of the things that I really wanted, one of the only things I really wanted to change. So we started making lagers right off the bat and really trying to turn them around and keep many of them up at a time. And I, coming from Greenpoint, like we talked about working with Chris and finding a love for lagers there, we'd always done them in a traditional style where we actually properly lagered them. And I just had this yearning to just I don't know. You know, now I'm working with Alex apparently for a year. Sorry, dude. But
congratulations.
Congrats. You know, Alex and I really like Yi's character and Yi's forward beers. And over a little bit of time, and with Brett Taylor, who we've been on the show with before, you've had on a number of times, who's opening Wild East pretty soon. We started thinking this through in a different way, and instead of trying to, we could still mimic these traditional styles, but we could do it in a way where you get some fresh yeast character, and I started thinking about them as farmhouse beers, which is sort of a 180 on what these things have traditionally been made as, but then not really so much, really.
You go to Germany, like. There's 1,000 tiny little breweries everywhere. They're all farmhouse breweries. They might be making lager beer, but I'd call it farmhouse as well.
So we started taking that ethos that we were applying to all our saisons and mixed firm and sour beers, and just sort of applying it to the lagers and going, you know, I'd really like a lager with a really fresh yeast character, and you know, where all the malts and the hops are super fresh, almost turning them around at ale speed. So at Keg and Lantern, we're turning a lot of lagers around in like 2 weeks. Maybe 3 weeks. And and then they disappear in like 2 weeks. We don't even get to fully lager them. So, yeah, it's just sort of a twist on what tradition may have led you to.
Farmhouse lagers, Pete.
Farmhouse lagers.
Rustic.
You've been lucky. You get to travel a lot, Pete. I mean, you got to go to Scandinavia. You found the Kvek yeasts. You were in Germany.
Went to Newburgh today, Newburgh, New York.
Up in Hudson Valley.
Making a beer with those guys.
What beer are you making with those guys?
Well, it's funny. I was there with Chris Basso, and he was a Brooklyn Brewery alum, so I knew him back then. Excellent brewer. Great guys. Love that place. They're killing it. We love lagers. Today we were just drinking their corn lager, but we're making a fruited IPA. So we like IPAs too. So up there, fruited IPA, but when they come down to ours for the return brew, I think we'll probably do an adjunct lager. They've got a lovely corn lager. We have a rice lager. Maybe we'll do a 50-50 corn and rice lager. Did one of those in the UK, and it turned out amazing with Northern Monk. And we did a corn and rice double IPA with Chris Prout when he was at Gun Hill. Well, he's still at Gun Hill, but did a collab with them, double adjunct. Now, that was the GBA beer, sorry. That was with Eric Olson when he took the helm at Greenpoint Beer and Ale. But, yeah, we'll do a lager when he comes down.
Yeah. Does anyone want to talk about using adjuncts? I mean, Alex, you were talking about working with different malts and grains. I mean, I want to go in the direction of talking about different grains.
Sure, I mean...
I think that's a big part of lagers.
One of the things I found it to be really interesting, and it works in some ways, and then sometimes it doesn't. But like, I started brewing with wild rice a lot, which I don't even know that it's strictly actually a rice. It maybe actually is a seed, but you cereal mash it, and that, you know, some of these things have their constraints. They aren't entirely affordable to use on a commercial scale. These are things I'm doing as a home brewer, buying, you know, weird grains at $3 a pound is not, and unless you have a bulk supply of that for cheaper, it's kind of not really tenable as a production brewery. But it's a lot of fun to just kind of do. I just made a lager with adzuki beans, inspired by some sort of Japanese tea where they use seaweed and red beans. And I effectively made the tea with the mash water prior to doughing in. I have it, that's still fermenting, so I don't know if that was an utter disaster, but I kind of am looking for, to me, it's like lager right now is just very much getting treated. I think the most interesting and far-flung thing people are doing with it is putting it into barrels and kind of treating it like a barrel-aged beer, but you're not seeing quite the depth that ale got as far as treating them differently. A lot of times it's within the construct of a style.
Who's putting lagers in barrels?
Oh, everybody now.
You guys are Keg and Lantern?
Keg and Lantern, we I guess we do have a
you
Stolen,
bring those
we have
in
Stolen
today?
Valor in a barrel. I forgot about that. And the Fooder Pills. Yeah, we do also do that. But that's Daydreamer, which is a slightly different hop.
I know threes that have Fooder Pills. Yeah. And Sven, what malts are you using? So this Born to Loose lager. What malts are in that?
We primarily use the 1886 Pilsner malt from 1886 up in, I think they're in Albany.
Yeah, I think they're just north of Albany.
Yep. Yeah, and amazing, they actually give a, they give an incredible yield. I mean, for some reason, they...
we got really good efficiency on our Jack's Heavy brews, too. They were like, what the... A lot better. Yeah, I don't know what the modification is on that or what the
it's
specs are.
Incredible.
They asked for the spec sheet, too, but they were like, wow, we got a really good efficiency on this.
We ended up having to correct it.
Yeah, I think ours was corrected as well.
Yeah.
No, Nolan and Robbie are doing, and the whole other rest of the crew, they're doing a great job up there, yeah? Oh,
yeah? Yeah, good guys.
Yeah. We also, I mean, we are inspired to do something with adjuncts, and I think we'll do corn on one of our next lagers.
I think Ted Hawley might be malting corn now, new at Craft Malt. We use a lot of his malt too, really good stuff.
So that's primarily what we've used in-house. We make a beer regularly called Present Tense, which is all New York ingredients Pilsner. It's all Ted's Excelsior Pilsner and Cascade hops from Chris Holden, who's Crooked Creek, who's now sort of the face of the
New York Hop
Guild. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you've had him on the show with Jason.
Yeah, no, this is exciting. I just love seeing how this industry is kind of coming together, and you guys are making lagers. You know, it used to take too much time. Now you're making them, and you're talking about the malts and hops that you're using from New York State. I have to take another short break. We'll be back in another minute here on Beer Sessions Radio. Oh, my God. What was that beer we just had? Nellis Helles.
Nellis Helles.
Nellis Helles.
Jimmy's renamed our beer Nelson Helles to Nellis Helles. I love it.
Nellis Helles on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
That's great.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Coral Lee, and I'm the host of Meant to be Eaten here on HRN. Every week, I look at cross-cultural exchange in food and contemporary media. What determines authenticity? What, if anything, gets lost in translation when cooking foods from another's culture? You can find Meant to be Eaten wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. So Jeff Lyons from Keg and Lantern, this is a nice beer. It's a Nellis Helles lager show.
It is now.
So as much as we appreciate the actual true to style classic styles and love playing with those, we also love to put a twist on some of those. So we'd been brewing a Helles for quite a while. At Greenpoint, we brewed a smoked Helles, which we really really liked, but. Once I got to Keg and Lantern, I was like, "Yeah, let's leave that alone for a little while. Let's not go into that territory." But we started putting spins on the Helles, and we threw Nelson into it maybe a year and a half ago, and it worked out really well. And I think this is the second time we've done it, maybe third, and it just works. Nelson Sauvignon hops from New Zealand, and it just works really well. Punches up the fruit. So, you know, when I was talking about turning out a lager with a little bit of yeast character, like fresh yeast character, you start adding some slightly fruity hops to it. And, you know, if you're subtle enough, it can turn out something really, really nice without really pushing too far.
The nose jumps right at me.
Yeah, it's a beautiful expression of Nelson Sauvignon. It's not over that head. It's not like hitting you over the head. This is Nelson Sauvignon. We got the hop. It's like, this is it. Level three.
You guys, as brewers that I respect, you know, we did the show on the Rothouse Pills a couple weeks ago, and that's got that kind of like bready, soft, you know, German lager feel. I mean, what do you do to get that? If you were going to make a Rothouse Pills, could you make it here in the States?
I think water chemistry is going to play a big role in that, and I think. Troop carryover. I think Freeman or Nitrogen might be a part of what's going on with these German lagers because they have a distinctive sulfur content. And German brewers are really into clarifying their wort before fermentation. I think most Americans are carrying over way too much Troop and way too much Freeman or Nitrogen. And I think our water chemistry is probably off for this particular style. You want some sulfur in there, so get some sulfates in your water, and you'll get it there as well. I think Rothaus is probably doing classic German fermentation, cold, cold, cold. We're doing much warmer over here, trying to squeeze them out a little faster. They got fresher ingredients. They got their local water supply, and oxygen levels. I'd be interested to see what they're doing there, and probably decoction. They're probably doing triple decoction on their malt. So that's not something most of us are doing over here. Jack's Abbey is doing decoction. But
I think when you start talking about all of the people who were really excited to see start making lagers, and when you start seeing this sort of almost mini explosion of lager brewers amongst craft breweries in the United States, I'm excited because I really like that fresh thing like we've been talking about. But I think one of the things that you miss when you have somebody who set themselves up as just a craft brewery, maybe an ale-centric brewery, and they start making lagers, is they're not doing those decoctions. And I think that's fine, but I think that turns out something very different than a traditional German or European lager-focused brewery who's set up to do single, double, triple decoctions. I think you just end up with very different beers.
Alex, were you going to say something? Because every time I've heard everyone talk about lagers, it's like, oh, we're doing decoction method. We're doing decoction method.
Oh, I just think, because one of the things I read on...
We're not.
Only the German guys.
Well, one thing I had read, and I don't actually know all that much about it, but on the homebrewing scene, it seemed like there was this budding interest in like low DO brewing, where I guess there's just like low amounts of dissolved oxygen throughout the brewing process.
We're looking into that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, as far as I understand, people suspect, because the Germans are very like tight-lipped, it seems, about what's going on with some of the character that's getting, you know, into their beers. And as much as people, we have great processes, but they, you know, it's pretty undeniable the character is different between American pils and a really nice German pils. But yeah, I'd seen a lot of speculation on the homebrew side about low DO and that being a prevailing thing that was really contributing to the character of these beers. And I think, you know, controlling the pH throughout the process, through many steps of the process, is another, you know, thing they don't really talk about, that, you know, how you're getting these malty flavors to really shine, but also that you're really getting the hop bitterness to be soft and those sorts of things.
So just to change it up to go to historical New York lagers, you know, we're talking about the characters of certain German, you know, water and other things. New York, you know, the classic lager was Rheingold, made in New York forever, and apparently Brooklyn Peels. Brewery, yeah, when they made the Brooklyn Lager was supposed to replicate like a Rheingold. It's kind of like an amber lager. Does anyone want to talk about that style, or is would you say, if I said a historical New York lager, would that be what you would think of?
I always assume they were just based on German pils, probably not anything other than a Pilsner malt. I know they were growing upstate was basically cluster hops. I always thought it would have been like a Hallertau or a Tettnang or a Saaz or something, but it was cluster. That was probably what they were using in all their lagers. I don't know how much. I heard that some of them were actually pretty hoppy. The water's probably not changed that much, but water does change over time. And the process has changed a lot. So I don't know what it would taste like. All these historical beers that you try to recreate, there's way too many parameters that you cannot hit. You cannot hit the raw ingredients, the climate of the time, the varietals that you were growing, the techniques of growing, the processing, the hops, the malt, the water's changed, everything's changed. But I would always assume they were more of a... based on a German classic lager, German pils. That Brooklyn lager is a very malty beer. That's kind of pushing a Märzen for me, but
yeah, with the amber Märzen, Jeff.
Also really hoppy though. That particular beer is really hoppy when you get a nice clean.
They're
hop.
Yeah,
nice,
I don't think that
cake.
Was meant to be a yeah. Rheingold hopping bill, but
I think just kind of building on what you were talking about.
Again, I've only had like. the revised
Cascade
Rheingold
in there.
I never had a classic Rheingold 50 years ago.
So yeah, I can't speak to any of that or the history that Pete possesses. But I think when
I'm
you start
100 years old, so
old soul, brother.
And you start drinking when you were two.
Negative two.
And Sven, what about you? So you're from Denmark. You know what lagers were you drinking? Because obviously European lagers were cooler, right? I mean,
I was drinking Tuborg and Carlsberg, and Skunk was a part of it.
And cold.
But the skunkiness. I mean, I
spent 6 months in Denmark, and I bought plastic cases full of each of those.
Yeah.
And Skunk was the thing that I take away from both of those.
That was certainly an ingredient.
I'm going to tell you guys my lager moment, which is so you go way back. So things I love things like Doppelbox, but I love, you know, one of my revelations in the 2000s was the Mars Ungespunden, this unfiltered Keller beer. Did you ever have that, Pete?
No, I don't think so.
That's one of those, like, from Mars. It's in Bamberg.
Yeah.
Has anyone had that beer?
Yeah, Ed used to bring those in. When I worked at Greenpoint, we'd have a really nice Oktoberfest celebration every year, and he'd bring some of the Mars and some of the other producers. I think you have. Yeah, some of the gravity casks.
They're really interesting. Shelton Brothers bring a lot of that stuff over, too.
Probably
Ed's bringing it with them.
Yep. Yep. We're speaking the same language.
Yeah.
We're all in the same
page. You know, there's a lot of history with lagers, and I'm really excited and happy that you guys were doing this show. Last one, the Dortmunder. And tell us about the style since you made it.
Man, I can't speak too much to the history of it, but it's just something that I've come across that I really liked the examples I had and wanted to give a go at it. And once I did, I really enjoyed what we had and how different it was, how malt-centric it was without any crystal malt. You just had this really...
It's got a little amber color.
Like full body malt character, but then the refreshingness of a lager. It just, kind of hit the right strings in my heart and just made me want to keep making it.
I have a little anecdote about the Dortmunder. I've met a couple of older gentlemen, both were ex-military, at this Thanksgiving thing I used to go to every year, and I'd bring beer down from my brewery, and then they're like, oh, I don't drink beer. But one of them, independently, one's like, but if you had this one beer, I would drink it. This one guy, like, he was in the Air Force. No, this guy was in the Navy, and he met some German sailors. They brought him back, you know, they were drinking. They went back to his ship, and they gave him this beer, and he's like, it's called Dortmunder. And he's like, if you had that beer, I would drink it. And then another guy, the Air Force guy, was like, I don't drink beer, but there was this one beer. Again, Dortmunder. So if I could have that Dortmunder from the I don't know what year that was, probably the 40s,
I've heard
phenomenal
stories of that
beer.
Where guys, American guys, ended up in Germany in the military.
Fell in love with Dortmunder.
Fell in love with good beers. Sven? Beer you fell in love with that was good?
Bunch, but I mean, when I grew up in Denmark, there was no good beer. So it wasn't until... I got you.
What do you like right now? Besides Suarez, I want to get a good lager. Anywhere in the world, what would I drink?
I couldn't answer that question. I think we have them right here.
So let's taste your Martin, too. You got one more beer. What is it?
One here. It's a Martin. And
we're trying to get all the beers in today. Our buddy Ethan is logging them in on Untappd. And Aaliyah's keeping tabs. We're going to have a nice photo of all these great beers. So I'm really fortunate. I feel really lucky to have you guys here. You have no idea how happy I am. I decided once again that I should just read the emails that come every Sunday. One thing so cool about the New York City craft beer community is that these breweries now on Sundays have to send out their lists of beers for sale that week because there's so much demand for them. Isn't that true, Jeff? I mean, you used to send them on Mondays and people were like, where's my list? You send them on Sundays now, guys start ordering on Sundays. And you probably sold out by Monday for the wholesale guys.
Yeah, we work on such a small scale that's absolutely, absolutely true. Yep.
That's great.
Goes super quick.
This smells amazing, by the way.
So the Dortmunder, and now...
about the hop bill.
Man, we're so lucky.
We're
so lucky to live in New York and have,
Pete,
so,
do you
many,
have the
so many great brewers with us.
Mars?
That's a Mars.
Yep. I'm drinking Sven's Mars.
Lagers and otherwise.
So this is Chinook and Citra. It's actually Sitra in the Whirlpool.
Very interesting, yeah.
And Chinook for the Bitterning.
Okay, excellent.
Guys, this is great. Let me push it to an hour. Thank you, Matt. Big thanks to everybody. Let's go around the room one more time. Everyone say their name and where they're from.
Pete Langell, KCBC.
Sven from Svenhal.
Alex from Keg and Lantern.
What's your last name, Alex?
Biederman.
Famous homebrewer.
Excellent homebrewer.
Ex-homebrewer.
Continuous homebrewer. Jeff Lyons, also continuous homebrewer. Jeff Lyons at Keg and Lantern.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer, Matt Patterson, intern, Aaliyah Papes. I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host. Thanks for joining us here on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo, woo, woo.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Martin! Martin on the time!
Don't worry about that. Hey!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.